May it please the court, I am Kyle Brenton, number 41405, representing appellant Scott Hutchins. The district court held that the debentures owned by Mr. Hutchins were no longer secured by the deed of trust because the statute of limitations on an action for collection of those debentures had expired. This was error. In 2003, Leadville Corp., the debtor under the debentures, executed documents acknowledging its debts to Mr. Hutchins. These acknowledgments restarted new six-year periods of limitations, and these restarted periods had not yet run at the time of trial. Therefore, Mr. Hutchins's action for collection of the debentures remained timely at that point, and the lien remained secured.
Was this argument preserved in the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. As we explained in the brief, Mr. Hutchins made this argument in his written closing argument to the district court. The argument appeared under separate heading. It cited the very case and statute that we rely on this appeal, and it presented the argument forthrightly and directly. Now, La Plata has argued that this position was not preserved because it was only 14 lines long and that it was simply not long enough. We have not found, and La Plata has not cited, a single case holding that in order to satisfy the preservation requirement, an argument must be lengthy. This argument was short because it was simple, and it clearly satisfied the preservation requirement. La Plata's only other response to the acknowledgement point is an attempt to confuse it with the second issue in our appeal. La Plata argues that an acknowledgement is in fact a modification of the underlying debenture, and thus requires two-thirds consent of the debenture holders in order to be valid. This is incorrect.
Mr. Britton, was that exact portion of your argument put into the closing, the written closing argument portion? I understand that you argued that it was an acknowledgement and that you cited case and statute, but was there any mention of the theory that it was not a modification, that an acknowledgement wasn't a modification?
As we stated in the closing arguments, the argument at the time was that an acknowledgement restarts the statute of limitations and that it hadn't run. There was no specific discussion of acknowledgement versus modification in the closing arguments because it was not necessary, not really presented at that point. And we had presented other arguments on the two-thirds consent language elsewhere in the closing argument. An acknowledgement is simply a written, signed statement by the debtor that a debt remains due. It's not a contract, and the law of contracts does not apply. It is a unilateral act by the debtor. The two-thirds consent clause, on the other hand, applies to modifications and alterations of the terms of the debenture. The debentures have no term related to the statute of limitations, and so an acknowledgement does not modify or alter the terms of the debenture, and the two-thirds consent clause does not apply. And in fact, La Plata has not disputed the substance of this acknowledgement point. They do not disagree that the 2003 agreements fulfilled the statutory and case law requirements to be acknowledgements. They do not dispute that the legal effect of an acknowledgement is to restart the statute of limitations. And they do not claim that the restarted periods had expired as of the time of trial. So, as once the preservation and two-thirds consent arguments are disposed of, there's simply no other response to this point.
Why wouldn't the acknowledgement constitute a modification in terms of changing the due date on the obligation?
An acknowledgement does not change the maturity date of the debenture. The maturity date of the debenture is simply the date that payment is due. Now, based on the operation of the statute of limitations, the statutory period begins running on that date. And an acknowledgement has no effect on that date, the date the period begins running. All an acknowledgement does is restart the running so that the end date, the final date on which a suit may be brought, is extended an additional 6 years. So an acknowledgement really has nothing at all to do with the terms of the debenture, and it does not modify them. Now, on our second issue, the interpretation of the modification clause itself. The modification clause requires that in order to modify the terms of the debenture, you must have the consent of the holders of two-thirds, quote, in aggregate principal amount of the outstanding debentures, close quote. As this language is written, the term outstanding modifies the noun debentures, not the phrase principal amount. Had Leadville intended for principal amount to mean outstanding principal amount, it would have written the debentures that way, but it didn't. And La Plata, neither La Plata nor the district court can make principal amount mean outstanding principal amount without moving the word outstanding.
Mr. Benton, doesn't this argument virtually eliminate the conversion portions of the debentures?
No, Your Honor. La Plata, as you've noted, has argued that once debenture principal is converted to stock, it can no longer be counted toward the two-thirds consent requirement because in some sense it doesn't exist. But the convertibility provision really has nothing at all to do with the modification clause and the two-thirds consent requirement.
But that means there's no longer any principal due by way of an indebtedness. It's been totally transformed into something else, hasn't it?
That is correct. That Leadville would no longer owe the principal that has been converted. That's correct because it's been converted to stock. But the two-thirds consent clause does not instruct the reader to determine what the outstanding principal is. It instructs the reader to determine what the principal amount of the outstanding debentures is. And as we've cited in our brief, the meaning of the term principal amount is clear. We cited a business dictionary that points out that that meaning is the face value of an obligation. And face value means the value written on the instrument itself.
Even if the obligation has disappeared?
Yes, Your Honor. Even if the obligation has disappeared, because the modification clause and the convertibility provisions are separate. And frankly, conversion of debenture principal to stock, as we say, has nothing to do with modification. The text of the modification clause is clear, and it instructs the reader only to count principal amount. And La Plata has pointed to no other definition of the phrase principal amount from any dictionary or case. They have simply urged this court to adopt a holistic interpretation of the modification clause and characterized reliance on its plain language as hyper-technical. But the placement of the word outstanding to modify the noun debentures rather than the phrase principal amount has meaning and must be given effect. To hold that the two-thirds consent clause requires counting the outstanding principal amount rather than the principal amount would be to rewrite the language of the debentures. So to sum up on this point, principal amount means face value. And in 2003, Mr. Hutchins and his allied parties controlled more than two-thirds of the aggregate principal amount of the outstanding debentures. For that reason, the 2003 agreements were valid and extended the maturity dates of Mr. Hutchins' debentures, and his Jefferson County action for collection of those debentures was timely as a matter of law. Even if you disagree with us on either of those two arguments, however, the district court must still be reversed based on waiver of the two-thirds consent provision. From the time the debentures were issued in 1987 until this very litigation, no one, not Leadville and not one debenture holder, ever asked one question or even mentioned the existence of the two-thirds modification requirement. Time and again, Leadville sent out extension agreements to each debenture holder requesting term extensions, interest rate changes, and these extension agreements referred only to a debenture in the singular and never asked any holder to opine in any way on any other holder's extension. The holder simply signed these agreements and returned them. Nor does the documentary evidence reveal a single instance of Leadville attempting to calculate whether the two-thirds consent clause was met. This is true even for years such as 1993, when not all of the holders consented to their extensions. On such occasions, it would have been critical for Leadville to determine whether two-thirds consent was present and whether the debentures had been successfully modified. But the board of directors meeting minutes for that year reflect no discussion whatsoever of the two-thirds consent requirement. Nor did any holder ever ask any question about that requirement. And based on this unvaried course of conduct over a period of many years, the holders waived whatever rights they had under the two-thirds consent clause.
Did the trial court make a fact determination that there was no waiver?
Your Honor, the effect of the trial court's ruling is certainly to hold that there was no waiver. The order is not absolutely clear on all those points. I think, though, effectively, yes, there was a fact finding that there was no waiver.
So is it subject to the clearly erroneous rule then?
As we've argued in the brief, we believe that this determination is based entirely on undisputed facts and the documents in the record. So we believe this court can take a new look at it. But if the court were to determine that it was based on facts beyond those documentary and undisputed facts, yes, it would be subject to clear error review. In sum, the district court erred in holding that Mr. Hutchins' debentures were no longer secured, and the judgment must be reversed. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
And you have just under 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, excuse me. May it please the court. Dean Neuwirth, number 17181, here representing La Plata with co-counsel Richard Strauss. Regarding Hutchins' argument one, I'd like to make it very clear that there was only a tolling agreement on the statute of limitations with respect to one debenture, that was the Burkhart debenture. The other documents were not tolling agreements, they were extensions of the maturity date of the debentures. Those are exhibits DH-15 and DH-17 through 20. And if you look at paragraph 3 of those documents, they say, quote, the maturity date of the debenture shall be and hereby is extended to December 31st, 2003. So all of those documents, their express intent in the document itself is to extend the maturity date of the debenture, which is obviously a modification or alteration of the debenture itself. Therefore, all of those exhibits are subject to the two-thirds modification provision. I'll also add that Mr. Hutchins, in his testimony at trial, agreed that those particular exhibits, quote, extend the due dates of each debenture to December 31st, 2003, close quote. That's the June 18th transcript, page 133, lines 20 to 21. So the representation here that all of these debentures were subject to an acknowledgement is undercut by the fact that five of the six exhibits at issue expressly say what we're doing here is extending the maturity date of the debentures. That's the intent of the parties. That's the intent that needs to be followed. The fact that you can go back later and pull out some language out of context and indicate that it constitutes an acknowledgement that indirectly goes to the statute of limitations because it deals with defenses cannot undercut the express intent of the parties.
By extending the due date, though, don't they at the same time acknowledge the debt?
They do acknowledge the debt, and that takes me, Your Honor, to the other exhibit, the tolling agreement for Burkhart, which was executed as a backup to the extension agreement. So when they extend it, they acknowledge the debt, but they've extended it. And by extending the maturity date, they have modified or altered the document. And in order to do that, you needed to get the consent of two-thirds of the holders, and there wasn't.
Yeah. Perhaps backing up just a bit, I'd like to ask you about the preservation on the acknowledgement issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the written closing argument, they gave that whole argument a separate paragraph and cited a statute and a case. Why isn't that sufficient?
Here's what I was getting at, Judge. The closing argument by Mr. Hutchins was 55 pages of single space. There were literally dozens of issues there. The reason I felt it wasn't preserved is because the issue was not raised before trial and the issue was not raised at trial. The reason there was a trial was because Mr. Hutchins argued that there was an ambiguity in this provision, in the two-thirds provision. So when the judge is sitting at the trial acting as the fact finder, what she is doing is she's filtering all the evidence through the lens of the issues that have been raised up till that point. To throw in another issue after the fact, after the trial, and to do so in a very minimal way, a way which, and there is law, obviously, this court is familiar with, that says that, that issues certainly in this court need to be supported by legal authority and appropriately briefed. To raise it in that minimal way at that late stage, I felt violated the cases which say that an issue to be preserved needs to be, you have to give the court a meaningful opportunity to rule on it, and you have to give the court an adequate opportunity to rule on it. And given the context of the whole proceedings up to that point, I don't believe that the court was given an adequate or meaningful opportunity to rule on it.
But generally, it's still preserved if it's raised in a closing argument. Isn't that what the case law indicates?
Yes.
And this does have a separate treatment and heading, the argument as made in the written closing argument?
I'd have to go back. I don't disbelieve what Mr. Breton said, but I assume that's the case. So turning to the tolling agreement on Burkhart, that was, under the evidence in the case, that was intended as a backup to the extension of the maturity date. And the reason was because at that time, the one-third interest in that debenture was in the process of being sold to my client, and so Mr. Hutchins couldn't get the signature of all the owners to the debenture to sign off on that extension. So they went ahead and executed a tolling agreement based on the statute of limitations. But by reaffirming the debt, Judge Boris, and trying to loop back to answer your question, what that does, by reaffirming the debt, it necessarily extends the maturity date of the debt. The debt was originally due back in 97. Now they're purporting to say, well, the debt is due now, and because it's due now, we get to restart the statute of limitations. You don't get to extend the statute of limitations under the cases they cite. What you do is you reaffirm the debt, and because the debt has been made current, brought forward, now the statute of limitations can restart from this date forward. So that the tolling agreement doesn't add anything to the analysis. All it does is bring the date of the maturity of the debenture from the past up to the forward time and say, now we're going to restart the statute from this point forward. So the bottom line is that none of those documents change the analysis. And what this case comes down to, and the trial court properly perceived this, is how do you construe the two-thirds majority provision? So turning to that issue, we've got the phrase aggregate principal amount of the outstanding debentures. What does the word outstanding mean? Mr. Hutchins keeps saying the word outstanding has to modify the word debentures. We don't quarrel with that. What does it mean? If you look up that dictionary definition, and if you look in Webster's Third New International Dictionary, for instance, which is the dictionary most often cited by this court, what it means in this context is what is left. If you have an outstanding balance of the debt, the term refers to what is left at any given time.
Can it also mean those debentures that still exist and have not already been converted to stock?
Yes, but it also means, it means which debentures still exist and what amount do they exist in. They're outstanding in the sense that they haven't been, say, totally canceled, but they're outstanding to what degree. So here we have this conversion clause where the principal amount can ratchet down anywhere from whatever the starting point was all the way down to zero. If you're down to zero, then you're out. The debenture is no longer outstanding, doesn't exist, we don't count it. So, but let's say you're only halfway down. Let's say you started at 100,000 and you're down to 50,000. Well, you're not at zero, so we count you, but to what degree do we count you? Well, we don't count you at 100,000, we count you at 50,000 because that's the amount outstanding. That's the common sense interpretation based on the plain language.
Yeah.
And wouldn't the plain language be outstanding principal amount rather than outstanding debentures? That's the proper interpretation.
I didn't quite follow, Judge, I'm sorry.
If the language under your position, wouldn't it have to read the outstanding principal rather than the aggregate principal amount of the outstanding debentures? Again, drawing that distinction of what the modifier outstanding is used for.
Look, the way they're interpreting it, you have to add the word face amount or original amount into the phrase aggregate principal amount of outstanding debentures. You have to add the word face or original. Our interpretation says that the word outstanding in front of debentures modifies outstanding to mean whatever happens to be left. Either it's nothing or it's some lesser amount. You could also move the word to the front, but semantically it has the same effect. And one of the points we tried to make in our brief was that the way the parties before the dispute arose treated the meaning of it is they treated the word outstanding to refer to the amount of the debentures that was left over at any given time, because the debenture holders received these periodic notices from Leadville, and the periodic notices for people who converted part of their principal would say debenture outstanding or amount outstanding, which indicates that everybody understood that the amount outstanding was the amount of principal that was left over after conversions. And in terms of the language of the debentures, again, you've got to look not just at the whole phrase, but the whole document. And that's why we believe very strongly you can't ignore the conversion clause. And in the conversion clause, there's a provision that says that if you convert, you surrender your debenture. Well, if you surrender your debenture, the face amount is no longer there. You know, whatever you've got is effectively a new debenture at a lower amount. And Mr. Brenton said that this provision operates separately from the conversion provision. There's nothing in the document anywhere that would indicate why they would operate independently of one another. There's nothing that would indicate that you say Dr. Risk has a $900,000 principal amount that he can convert all of that to stock, become a stockholder in the amount of $900,000, exercise his rights as a stockholder, and yet at the same time continue to exercise his rights as a holder of principal and vote as a holder of principal as a creditor with the same people who have never converted. That would create a real inequity to classes of debenture holders. So for that reason, we believe that the district court properly interpreted the two-thirds modification provision, because she did so. Mr. Hutchins is time barred. He had every opportunity to bring suit on his debentures. When LaPlata filed suit before the six-year time bar had passed, he was notified, he was served. He had an opportunity to cross-claim against Leadville. He made a decision not to do that. That was his decision, that was a risk he bore, and the consequence is that he is time barred. With respect to the waiver argument that Mr. Hutchins has raised, the crux of the argument is that there's some language in the modification provision itself which requires every debenture holder to assent to an extension by every other debenture holder. I didn't see that in the opening brief. And in our answer brief, I dropped a footnote saying, you didn't explain where this comes from. They then come back and explain it in the reply brief. I think that that's barred because you don't get to raise new arguments in a reply brief. But if you're going to consider it, there is no waiver here. And Judge Capelke, getting to your question about did the trial court make effect determination of waiver, if you look at the structure of the trial court's ruling, the provision, the part of the ruling which deals with the modification provision, or excuse me, the two-thirds consent provision, that part also deals with modification and waiver. And the reason waiver is included there is because that's how it was presented by Mr. Hutchins. The waiver argument was presented as kind of a subset of the theory of contractual interpretation of the two-thirds provision. And that necessarily, therefore, when the court made her ruling about interpretation of the provision, she rejected the waiver argument. But there's actually some more. If you look towards the end of her ruling, and I'm going to cite the pages in the record, 1187 and 1188, these deal with Mr. Hutchins' defenses of estoppel and latches. And the basis for the estoppel defense was the same basis as the waiver defense, namely that nobody ever enforced a two-thirds provision. And the judge said, finding a fact, no evidence was presented to show that this provision had been ignored for estoppel purposes. And then the following page, she said, with respect to latches, there was no evidence presented by Mr. Hutchins to show that that provision had been waived for latches, that provision was invalid for latches purposes. And I would submit that because those findings, in fact, with respect to estoppel and latches apply just as strongly to waiver, because the basis of the estoppel and latches argument was the same basis as the waiver argument. Furthermore, with respect to waiver, there was just no evidence of waiver in the sense that if you look at what happened for every year from 1987 until 1997, except for 1993, Mr. Brett referred to multiple occasions, but there was only one year where anybody objected. Every other year, everybody agreed to every extension because they all agreed and they all knew that the others were agreeing. They all, by presumption, consented to extend each other's debentures. In other words, if this requirement exists, is what I'm saying, that the record shows there was an agreement, or it's at least as consistent with exercising the right as with objecting. The only year where there was an objection in 1993, what happened? Dr. Risk went out and he convinced that objector to cancel its debenture. Well, what that indicates is that he was aware of the two-thirds provision. He was aware that it needed to be complied with. And the way they complied with it, the way they got the two-thirds, was getting that very large debenture holder to cancel its debenture. So for those reasons, we believe that the trial court's ruling was appropriate and ought to be affirmed. If I could speak very briefly about the cross-appeal in my 20 remaining seconds, there should be a money judgment on the Clement debenture because you can get, that has value because we can get a separate judgment lien on it and we can use that judgment lien for various purposes. Unless the court has any other, I just don't have time to get to the other cross appeal issues. If the court has other questions, I thank the court for its time. Ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment but enter judgment for La Plata on the cross appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neuwirth. Rebuttal.
Thank you. Just briefly, on the acknowledgement point. First, Mr. Neuwirth has discussed the Burkhart tolling agreement in a great deal of detail. We discussed the tolling agreement on the Burkhart debenture as a separate point in our opening brief. The acknowledgements that we are contending restarted the statute of limitations are all contained within the 2003 agreements. And Mr. Neuwirth gave you the exhibit numbers of those. And there is one of those for the Burkhart debenture as well. Now, we certainly don't disagree with any of the language that Mr. Neuwirth read from the 2003 agreement. As I said earlier, part of the purpose of the 2003 agreements was to extend the maturity dates of the debentures. And whether that was valid or not is an issue of the interpretation of the two-thirds consent clause, which we've discussed. But in addition, in separate paragraphs, Leadville, quote, hereby confirms and reaffirms that the debenture remains issued and outstanding, so forth, has accrued interest, continues to accrue interest, and is secured by the modified deed of trust.
Yeah. Mr. Pitten, can you quickly address the argument about conversion creating two classes of debenture holders?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Judge Kopelke's question about when is a debenture outstanding really gets right to the heart of this argument. A debenture is outstanding when any principal or interest remains due. And Mr. Neuwirth discussed the example of Dr. Risk when he was discussing this two classes of holders issue. Dr. Risk in 1991 converted all the $900,000 in principal on his debenture into stock. He did not convert any of the $400,000 interest that had accrued on his debenture and continued to accrue interest in the future. Now, Dr. Risk was the president of Leadville when it issued the debentures. And it is, as we've argued in our brief, it is simply unreasonable to assume that in taking this action, in converting $900,000 but leaving almost $500,000 in interest, he was intentionally disenfranchising himself. He was intentionally stripping himself of any future vote on the maturity date, on the interest rate, or other provisions of the debentures. So that, I think the example of Dr. Risk demonstrates just how unreasonable this outstanding principal amount argument actually is. As long as the debenture remains outstanding, which is to say any principal or interest remains due, the principal amount of that debenture, which is the face value of that debenture, is still counted. And, you know, it is not our position, Your Honor, that the term stated amount or face value has to be read in to the modification clause, as Mr. Neuwirth has maintained. The phrase principal amount, the two-word phrase, already means face value. And Webster's Dictionary has no separate definition of that two-word phrase. It's a business term of art. And that's why we've cited a business dictionary. Briefly, as to the preservation point, Mr. Neuwirth raises the argument that we didn't raise our interpretation before trial. That's not strictly true. In our pretrial memorandum, we discussed the possible interpretations of this phrase. In addition, though, at trial, we presented evidence. Because it was a bench trial, we presented our legal arguments in closing argument. So that was exactly the right time to raise this argument. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much to counsel for your excellent arguments.